The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
We have made our start. 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting for 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good morning, listeners. Welcome to the Friday morning Space Show program, West Coast time in the United States. It's a pleasure to be here. We have a terrific show for you today, and pay attention to this one. It's a one-hour show with a hard stop at the bottom of the hour. So if you are planning to call and talk to our guest, or you want to send an email in, it is a hard stop. So please do so when we have time to answer your questions or talk with you. And in addition, the only other announcement is that Father's Day is this Sunday in the United States. There will be no space show. I don't usually do shows on Mother's Day and Father's Day. So we resume on Tuesday. And I hope everyone has a great weekend and you can be with family and friends instead of listening to the space show. A couple of other real quick notes. Our toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223, and email drspace, drspace, at thespaceshow.com. Our newsletters will be updated this weekend, so what you see on the website right now is for this current week that's about to expire. Everything we do is archived, and you can listen right off of our website. Those are compressed MP3 recordings, or our podcasts. We're in most of the popular podcast servers. And you can also very quickly download the show if you want. The file sizes are not very large. We also have a store. If you're interested in Space Show logo wear, to access our store, please click on the pictures of Pepper, the Siberian Husky, listening to the Space Show. And she will take you directly to our program. A couple of other things of interest. In the upper left menu, there is a Listen Live button. This tells people how to listen to the live broadcast, which is what we're doing right now, and also how to listen to the podcast and the MP3s on our website. In addition, remember that we are a nonprofit, 501c3 in the United States, with One Giant Leap Foundation as our parent. And as a nonprofit, if you donate to us, and we hope you do because we're listener-supported radio, but if you do donate to us, you get an IRS tax deduction, providing you pay federal U.S. taxes. And we are also a 501c3 in California for the present time, soon to be in Nevada. But check with your local state to see if you can claim the nonprofit deduction at the state level for a state other than the state of your residence. Some do allow it, some do not allow it. And if I can help you in any way, just please email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. Don't forget we have sponsors, and we have a billboard program. So you can put your message out on our website with banner ads. You can change the banners whenever you want. On longer formatted shows, I read the sponsor's message, which the sponsor has given me. But today on the shorter programs, I shout out to our great sponsors. We would not be doing this program without their great help. Northrop Grumman, the Space Foundation, Astrox, AIAA, Moonwords, Celestis, and the National Space Society. And once again, we are listener-supported. There's a very large PayPal button at the top of our homepage. That's the easiest way to support us. If you're old school and you want to use a check, it's made payable to One Giant Leap Foundation. And please use the address on the website. That's our new address in Las Vegas, Nevada. That's where you should mail the check to. And we definitely appreciate that. So for today's program, we are really honored to have Sir Martin Rees back with us and author Donald Goldsmith. They have a terrific new book. It's called The End of Astronauts, Why Robots Are the Future of Exploration. Don has written more than a dozen books, including Exoplanets, The Runaway Universe, The Hunt for Life on Mars, Supernova, and along with Neil deGrasse Tyson, Origins. He has a Lifetime Achievement Award for Astronomy Education from the American Astronomical Society and for the popularization of astronomy from the Astronomical Society of the Pacific. Sir Martin Rees is the UK's Astronomer Royal. He's been a previous guest on the Space Show a few times. He was the professor of astronomy and director of the Institute of Astronomy at Cambridge, and his bio goes on and on and on. Both of these gentlemen have their full bios up on the Space Show website, and I urge you to read to them. But we have only a one-hour show to be with both of them, with a terrific book, with a great, great thesis behind it. So, Martin and Don, welcome to the Space Show. Martin, why don't you lead us off and introduce us to the end of astronauts, okay?
Yes. Well, thank you. Let me say it's great to be on the show again and to tell you a bit about our book. Don Goldsmith and I are both enthusiasts for space, including human spaceflight, and we're both old enough to have remembered Neil Armstrong's One Small Step on the Moon, One Great Leap for Mankind. We both remember that. And I think we both felt at that time that it wouldn't be more than a decade or two before there were footsteps on Mars. But, of course, that didn't happen. The Apollo program is still a high point of human spaceflight. And our book really addresses why that is the case and what the future of human spaceflight is. Of course, in the 50 years since the Apollo program, space technology has advanced hugely. We depend on space every day for sat-nav communications, weather prediction, and all that. And, of course, robotic probes have given us close-up views of all the solar system, have landed on Mars and other places. And, of course, astronomers have benefited from telescopes in space, most recently the James Webb telescope. So hugely important advances are made possible by space. But what about human spaceflight? Of course, as everyone listening to the program probably knows, about 500 people have been into space in the last 50 years, most of them on the International Space Station, into low Earth orbit, which is fine, but it's not specially sort of glamorous compared to footsteps on the moon, of course. And what's happened is that robotic technology has advanced so much that we don't think the practical case for humans will ever become strong again, because exploration by probes on Mars with AI can do much of what a geologist could do, and robots can fabricate large structures in space, etc. But, of course, sending humans, especially as far as Mars, is hugely more expensive than sending a robot, because you've got to feed the human and keep it safe for 200 days, whereas the robot just hibernates. And so I personally don't feel that NASA should spend so much money on human spaceflight. And the reason I say that is not because human spaceflight's not important, but it's because NASA has to be very risk-averse now. You remember that shuttle was launched 135 times, and it failed twice. And each of those failures was a national trauma, which killed civilians and delayed the program. And that's because it was presented as being safe, space tourism. And even though the risk from those numbers is less than 2%, that was thought hard to accept for sending up American citizens. So we think that there should be human spaceflight, but it should be left to the private venturers, the billionaires and sponsors, because they could do it more cheaply by launching only the kind of people who are prepared to take higher risks. And we know that people who go hang gliding and test pilots, etc., are fully prepared to take a risk of more than 2%. And I hope very much that there will be some such people who will go into space, launched probably by the private companies like SpaceX, and that there will even be some people on Mars by the end of the century, but they'd be privately funded, going as an adventure and accepting it's dangerous, and we'll cheer them on. But we don't think that NASA should be spending taxpayers' money sending people when all the practical things could be done far better by robots.
And yet we have a NASA program with many other nations are joining in on Artemis to precisely put humans on a permanent base on the moon.
I personally don't support that.
You're not supportive of that? I missed what you said.
I don't. I think if you think of the cost of sending humans compared to sending robots, and the fact that it's very expensive if you try to keep the risk down, then I don't think we should be paying taxpayers' money on this. But I think we should cheer on adventurers who are prepared to go on a cut-price, high-risk venture. We'll leave it to them.
One of the considerations has always been that look how slow, for example, the rovers move on Mars. And yet, if you had a geologist on Mars or a scientist on Mars, look how much progress they could make just in one day or one week compared to what a rover does. I mean, it's light years of difference.
Yes. Well, that's true, but the gap is closing, although the cost gap isn't, because if you compare Curiosity and Perseverance, Curiosity moved very slowly because it had to report back to Earth if it encountered a rock in front of it. It couldn't figure out how to change course. Perseverance can work out how to change course and therefore can move much faster. And I think it's a reasonable extrapolation that in 10 or 20 years there'll be enough AI in these robots that they can actually do some geology and decide what's a specially interesting place to dig. So they're catching up.
If I may jump in here, Martin.
Is remaining huge.
Please do. Go ahead, Don.
Thanks for letting me be here. If you compare, say, Perseverance took a year to do what a human geologist would do in a week, it's still far cheaper. Yes, you have to wait the year, but it would do a far more careful job. The human geologist, after all, would have to be housed and fed oxygen and all the rest. Wouldn't have a totally easy time working. These already Perseverance could carefully, very carefully cover the terrain, look at everything, take samples, which we hope to return to Earth pretty soon, and so forth. And as Martin says, that's today. Give it 10 years and there'll be even no comparison, and we're left with the idea of people want to see humans on Mars. It's understandable, but how much do we need them? Same with the moon. When you ask, why do we need a human base on the moon? What are they supposed to do that machines couldn't do better and far more cheaply? There's no easy answer. It basically boils down to desire.
So what would you advise then regarding the Artemis program, which is well on their way and, you know, contracts in metal are being bent for human landers on the moon? I mean, this program is going forward with government money, with taxpayer money, and government astronauts, so they're not listening to the two of you so far.
Yes. Martin might know something deeper, but fundamentally we're unable, the two of us, to stop the Artemis program, though we do what we can, which is very, very little in terms of influence. But let's put it this way. Suppose Artemis goes forward. We put humans on the moon very expensively. It may well turn out that people realize, what is this all about? What is it they're doing? And it will, after all, bring with them tremendous robotic equipment, which they will set in motion. The ultimate goal of astronomers for now is to put a telescope on the far side of the moon, a radio telescope, free from interference from the Earth, because the moon would block it. That can be done robotically, if not today, certainly in a decade. The concept of needing humans in space is lodged in our brains very firmly, partly because we like humans, but even more from, you know, movies and television and everything else. But when you stop and think about it, it's just, as Martin and I like to say, very expensive, very dangerous. And you could have adventurers, but they are not, after all, going to build telescopes or anything else. It's a whole different ballgame there.
I have an email from Todd in San Diego, California, for both of you. And Todd says, while space was advancing and it has provided us with great robotic and AI and other technology, humans did not really advance for space flight. So we're still stuck with the same problem in Leo that would likely be enhanced if we go elsewhere. This has been going on for the 50 years since Apollo, and you can't chalk it all up to the fact that humans shouldn't be in space, robotics should be there. Why do you think the human side of space has not advanced nearly as quickly as the scientific side? It has to be more than just the cost factor.
Well, I'll speculate it's also the ability factor. Human bodies have not advanced any further, but robotics and AI have advanced tremendously. When you ask now, what should we send into space, say, to the moon or to Mars or to Venus or the satellites in Jupiter and Saturn, even before you get to the cost, you say, what could humans do that robots can't do better? I urge people who are listening and anyone else who will listen to think about just what they have in mind is what these human activities are.
Gentlemen, you already have a listener phone call, so let me patch in our listener. Good morning, listener. Welcome to the show. Who are you? Where are you, please?
Good morning. This is Bill calling from Raleigh.
Hi, Bill. Welcome to the show again. How are you doing?
Good, thanks. And it's a pleasure to speak to both guests today. I'm looking forward to reading the book. Because I haven't, I wanted to ask a quick clarifying question. It sounds almost as if you're defining an astronaut as being a government-sponsored astronaut, since you are still talking about the private sector going into space. Is that part of your premise?
Can I just comment on that question? I think it is different.
Sure.
Because when private people do something dangerous and they die, then we may say that's the way they wanted to go. To give an example, in this country, Britain, there's a very dangerous motorcycle race once a year. And 5 people were killed in it this year, but they all said that was the way they wanted to die. They're prepared to take these risks. But I think it would not be acceptable for the government to pay for people to be exposed to these risks. So I think we should leave it to those who choose to accept these great risks, and then we warn brave and resourceful people if they die. But I think it's not the same as publicly funding people who may be exposed to these risks. I think there's a difference between those who choose to go and are privately funded and those who are paid for by the government, as we see by the fact that it was headline news when the 2 shuttle crashes happened, whereas there have been occasions, I mean, 3 people were killed when one of the private rockets blew up on the launch pad. It didn't even make the front pages. So there's a different attitude.
Don?
Okay. Go ahead.
No, I was going to ask Don if he had a comment on that.
No, I'll pass on that partly because I had a little trouble hearing everything, and I'm sure that Martin did a fine job of replying.
Bill, do you have anything further?
I guess just to follow that up a little bit, it sounds like you're not advocating an absence of humans in space, but really, I know book titles have to be catchy, but maybe it's more like the diminished role of astronauts in space exploration. Is that closer to the premise?
I'll say that even if I'm repeating what Martin said, astronauts are going to play a role in near-Earth orbit, low-Earth orbit, indefinitely. They're there. They're going to have plenty to do, even though one could argue that they are too. We do many things better with the robots. And that hardly enters our argument because, you know, it's right next to Earth. It's the longer expeditions, say, there's the moon to begin with, but especially Mars, which is in everyone's mind, where it begins to make very little sense aside from the glory of it and the need for human achievement. And if we do send astronauts to Mars once, that might seem enough, although who's to say how we'd regard them? At any rate, there's a sharp definition just by the distance, in my opinion, and astronauts, in that sense, will always be there, and our book is really only talking about beyond low Earth orbit.
I see. Okay. Thank you. And I guess it just seems like a very logical, very rational argument, but it's sort of hard a hard argument to hear on the emotional side as a human, because we never...
If you're saying that rationality only takes us part way through any argument, you're perfectly correct. See daily life.
Thank you very much, Bill. Appreciate the call.
Okay, very good.
Listeners, the line is available. If you would like to give us a call, 866-687-7223. You have another email that has come in from Carol in Seattle. And Carol says, what about the idea of government astronauts paving the way like a permanent lunar base on the moon and then turning it over to the private sector? But because it would be so heavily R&D oriented, it seems appropriate for the government to help develop that infrastructure. So what are your thoughts on using government to help develop something, and then when it's developed, turn it over to the private sector?
Oh, I'll jump in, though, really, Martin, this wants to be heard from. First of all, this is a very American question. If we're talking about Chinese astronauts on the moon, it'll be answered very differently. Secondly, it's not at all clear to me, at any rate, that there's so much for private investment and private operations to do on the moon. One talks about mining various useful things from helium-3 to certain minerals. All of this is, you know, just as easily done on Earth. We don't mine the bottom of the oceans yet, though they're rich in such materials. So the deeper question is, to me, again, what are we paving the way for? And also, there's also one about why the government should pay to lend the way to private industry if they're so interested. Let them do it. If Elon Musk turns from adventuring to wanting to build a factory on Mars or the moon, I guess we can't stop him, though I'd like to.
So you would be supportive of space tourism or even space settlement as long as it remains the venue of the private sector. Is that correct?
Let Martin go on that one.
Yeah, yes. I think I would. I would cheer them on, even those who go with the one-way tickets. But obviously, I think we as taxpayers would not want to feel responsible for their choice. It wouldn't surprise me if there are people on Mars by the end of the century. Elon Musk has famously said he wants to die on Mars but not on impact, and he's now about 50 and 40 years' time. He may be able to go to Mars, and good luck to him. We'll cheer him on. But the main point is this is a dangerous adventure which we should treat like other very dangerous human activities, and which we should cheer on, but which the public shouldn't be expected to support.
Carl is in Phoenix, Arizona, with an email for you. And he says, you've talked about how AI and robotics will advance even over the coming 10 years. Don't you think in 10 years the risk for humans in space will be brought down significantly and it won't be as risky?
We'll certainly know, won't we, if we start launching more astronauts. So far, so good since the last disaster. But I don't see, not that I'm a technologist, exactly what's gone so much better with launching rockets that they can't have these mistakes. Look at the two shuttle disasters. They dealt with things that people hadn't thought through carefully. And yes, we learned from that one, but who knows what we won't think through carefully the next time. But, you know, I'm sort of a careful pessimist that way, as is NASA. This is why we can certainly test it out by having private enterprise people go and take the risks, and the data will keep coming in.
You have another email from Dr. Jim Dewar, D-E-W-A-R. Let me see if I can read all of it to you. I agree with the basic thrust of your argument, but observe the argument is premised on chemical propulsion, which yields a payload fraction of around 2%. If you go to more advanced propulsion systems, such as nuclear thermal, the argument loses validity. In 1969, Rocketdyne analyzed putting a first-generation Nerva engine on the third stage of a Saturn V and found it could double the payload to LEO from 250,000 to 500,000 pounds. Then going nuclear gas core with their specific impulses of around 8,000 seconds means Mars in only a month. So propulsion is the key to the argument, true for chemical and not for advanced, such as nuclear. Jim Dewar, your thoughts on his propulsion argument and nuclear propulsion?
Yes.
I'd like Martin to start
first of all,
on that one.
We are not thinking that far ahead. I mean, clearly there could be unenvisioned progress, which would indeed change the basis of the argument. But that's certainly possible. But I think still, the idea of sending people to Mars, where it's going to be maybe weeks rather than months if we have new propulsion, but they've got to be fed, they're exposed to radiation dangers, etc. And more important, the return ticket is going to cost 10 times as much as the one-way ticket, because you have to take to Mars all the requirements for the return trip. And so it's still going to be very expensive, although, of course, you're quite right that for both manned and unmanned probes, we will benefit if there are more efficient propulsion systems.
Do you think that as time goes on, government may see space kind of less as a national prestige, because perhaps human spaceflight for government is a big prestige item? So if governments got over the prestige factor of humans in space and were willing to do as you suggest, humans on the private side, robotics and AI, and real exploration on the government side, they might be more willing to consider the type of approach that you're thinking of. But as long as we're looking at flags and footsteps, it seems like human spaceflight will still be a big part of government policy.
It may be, but I would just note, because I speak as a Brit, not an American, that after having spent up to 4% of the U.S. federal budget in the late 1960s on Apollo, having beaten the Russians to the moon, there was no motive to continue that great expenditure and head for Mars. The expenditure on NASA, of course, was cut right down. So I think there's a limit, I would have thought, to what any nation is going to spend on human spaceflight just for prestige reasons, and bearing in mind that it can backfire, because if they're disasters, then they are negative for the prestige of that country. So I just accept that prestige was a key argument. Superpower rivalry with Russia was crucial to giving the impetus to the Apollo program, but I just don't feel that that's going to be sufficient. We'll have to see. Maybe the Chinese will head for Mars. We don't know. But I just doubt that it's going to be something which will be funded at the level necessary to make it safe.
I have another email from for both of you, or one of you may choose to answer it. This is James in Denver, Colorado. And James says, it appears that we are moving toward private sector rockets. Although SLS may still fly, but it may not be competitive, so it may not fly for very long. As long as we're using the private sector to make rockets, doesn't that kind of negate your argument about the risk factor? Because why would the private sector have safer rockets if they're going into space with humans that NASA is using or not using? It seems to me that if you wanted to be really safe, they'd only go with government rockets. But that isn't what's unfolding right now.
If I understand the question correctly, as Martin was saying, NASA and the government do want to be safe, and this inhibits them from doing what the private enterprise and private individuals can do. And not too surprising, that is what's happening, which basically we support far more than government expenditure. So I'm not sure whether we're not just in total agreement on this one. Maybe Martin can comment.
Martin, any comments on private rockets?
I agree with that. I think it's great what SpaceX is doing in cutting the cost of huge rockets which can launch 100 tons into low Earth orbit and could launch something as big as the James Webb Telescope in one piece of the nose cone. This is a huge advance, and we should cheer that on. But this may indeed bring down the risks. But still, the fact remains that the government has to be more risk-averse than a private company can be if it launches adventurous humans.
You don't think government could shed some of its risk-averseness and be willing to take on more risk like it did during the Apollo era?
Well, that depends on on the views of the average citizens. I mean, the fact that the shuttle only failed twice in 135 launches didn't stop the two crashes, the one with the woman school teacher and etc., being national traumatic events, delaying the program with efforts to make it even safer. So I think if public opinion changed, then you'd be right. But it's not clear to me that public opinion is going to change to make it more acceptable for people to die when they're paid for by the taxpayer.
Him another email. This is Ben sent in a note from New York City. And he says, if we look for government to do only scientific and exploring missions and NASA, NASA usually chooses these missions through the process of the decadal survey. Is that the best way to explore? Would there be an alternative to selecting missions through the decadal process? It seems to me that that's awfully narrowing and restricting. And if NASA is only going to be doing government missions or exploratory missions without any human spaceflight, that they should expand how they do these missions and represent more of the taxpayers than just the scientific community.
Well, I mean, of course, I'm not entirely familiar with how the U.S. funds other kinds of space, but of course, a lot of funds are being spent on environmental monitoring, climate prediction, etc., which is done as a public service by NASA. So it's not the case that NASA will be limited to doing just the scientific programs recommended by the Decatur Survey. It's doing lots of other unmanned programs, and so is ESA on this side of the Atlantic.
Listeners, we can still take your phone calls, 1-866-687-7223, and email drspace@thespaceshow.com. I know that if space settlement and tourism exists, it's for the private sector. I mean, you're pretty clear on that. Do you see any downside in space tourism or space settlement? Should it be something like what O'Neill did in space? Or should we build habitats and structures on the moon and on the surface of Mars, even if it's the private sector? Because many don't want the private sector doing anything like that in space. So
I'll jump in on that one.
Okay.
First of all, the idea of stopping the private sector would be a very impressive movement of government power, but we could think about it. But broadly speaking, as a moral question, the idea of people who have the money and the means to go to Mars and doing what they like there is a little upsetting, especially for those who hope to find signs of life on Mars, either existing Mars, which turns out to be possible, or certainly ancient life, which seems very highly probable. We will one day find some evidence. We want to be sure it wasn't brought from Earth. After all, there's a lot of speculation that life itself transferred itself from one planet to another long, long ago through meteoroids and so on. Whatever you do to an environment, and even our automated robots do this, you have to be careful, if you can, that you're not accidentally seeding the ground with the wrong kind of information. So that's a basic biological thought, and the bigger one is just when you think of people working their will, say, digging up the moon for their private gain, I may be something of a progressive, but it strikes me the wrong way because it leads to, a wholesale race. I'll just point out the thought of the best spot on the moon to set up a base would be at the southern pole of the moon where the sun never sets in a certain place called the Peaks of Eternal Light. You could get solar power all the time. And the day when we have competing powers or competing private enterprises there, that would bring back memories of, the gold rush or something.
What about asteroid mining? I know that government's not going out to do asteroid mining, but the privates are. Do you see that in the same way as putting something on the moon or on Mars?
I should really let Mars come in here, but
yes,
it has the same sort of feeling of ripping things up. But, if they can do it, sort of more power to them, it's really a difficult job. We've got things right here on Earth.
Martin, you were going to say something?
Yes, Well, I was going to say, really, that the economic case for mining asteroids is unclear, but I don't think it raises quite the same concerns about polluting a possible living system which might exist on Mars. So I'm slightly more relaxed about that. But going back to the question of O'Neill colonies and all that, this is certainly beyond the 21st century, which is really the limit of our serious extrapolation in our book. But I do think that it is a dangerous delusion to think we can escape the Earth problems by mass migration to Mars, because to terraform Mars, to make it habitable to ordinary people, is far, far harder than dealing with climate change on the Earth. So we should stick to dealing with climate change and regard Mars as a place just for a few extreme enthusiasts, not for mass emigration. And as far as the O'Neill colonies are concerned, would people really want to live there? I don't know. It's a sort of a California suburb, but not as nice as the real one. And so I don't know why people want to go there. I think Bezos has an idea of moving some kinds of industry into space, and in principle that could be a good idea, but I don't know the details. So these very grand, large-scale projects, which are for the 22nd century and beyond, should be considered, but they're quite different. And, of course, political systems may be quite different, and the balance between public and private may be quite different. So I think we are pretty agnostic about those long-term issues.
The space show has a lot of listeners that are very excited and supportive of the idea of living on an O'Neill cylinder and even having children,
yeah,
and spinning at 1G so that you remove the gravity problem from, say, having children or family. Mm-hmm. I'm hoping a couple of them are listening to the show and they will call in and tell us why they want to live on an O'Neill cylinder. It might be a very interesting commentary. So, guys, if you're listening, call us and tell us why you want to live on that. 1-866-687-7223. The ideas that you're putting forth in the book, are they? I can understand how maybe people in the United States might go for it and accept it, and might even eventually design space policy around what you're talking about. But we're not the only players in space. There's China, there's Russia, there's India, there's Israel. A lot of countries have started commercial space organizations in their countries, not just for financing, but you know, to do projects. So do you see the kind of ideas that you're talking about being widely accepted for government policy, or narrowly accepted, or is it a real uphill battle to think away the way you do in creating policy?
Yes. Well, I mean, I would say, and I think Don would agree, that case for sending humans rather than robots is getting weaker all the time, and that would apply to any of these nations doing projects to mine asteroids or go to the moon. And I think in the very long term, we can't predict what will happen. But in the short term, I would have thought the arguments probably apply even more strongly to nations that have smaller budgets than the United States does.
Bill has a comment for you. He's a gentleman that called a little while ago. He says, I seem to have lost my connection in the middle of a question. I was noting that the argument of the book is logical. Where I was going is that we haven't encountered a place so far that humans couldn't go. We've explored all the land masses, the deep ocean, and now space. It seems that we like the stories that feature humans venturing out, and that's probably been the case for hundreds or thousands of years. I'm wondering if this is something you've considered in formulating your book, and whether that might explain why we persist in human space exploration.
Well, I'll try it on that one. First of all, as you know, until recently, we didn't have any alternative. Columbus did not send a robot across the Atlantic to see what was there. Now we do. But to the basic point, We love human explorers. They're great tales, even the ones who fail, Scott, Antarctica, and so on. Great heroes. These people are heroes. The question is that enough reason for the expense, the danger, and so on? I like to phrase it simply as, how much do we need astronauts versus how much do we want astronauts? If we want them strongly enough, then never mind the need. We'll have them. But the thought that this is our destiny always to send humans sort of misreads what's happened in the last generation of technology.
Got another caller for you. Good morning, caller. Welcome to the program. Who are you and where are you, please?
This is John in Fort Worth.
Hi, John. Welcome back.
Listen to this general line of thinking. I'm kind of like, well, should life have come out of the oceans or should it have stayed there? I mean...
Yes.
It's a good question. I've never thought about that one.
Can I respond to that? I think if you think of a long time scale of Darwinian evolution, then, of course, we'd be talking about not humans, but sort of post-humans of some kind. We've no idea what their preferences or abilities would be. But that's a very long-term vision of entities very different from human beings. But if you think of human beings, the previous questioner made the point that we've been to the bottom of the ocean and places like that. But no one wants to live at the bottom of the ocean. Very few people want to live near the South Pole. And they are more clement and accessible than living on Mars. So I do question how many people are going to want to go to Mars, except those who are going as an adventure, like Scott of the Antarctic and people like that. So I think there are places where people could go, but the idea of a mass movement to go there seems to me very implausible, so long as we have humans as they are now and human nature as it is now. But if you think a very long time into the future, and a little transition from humans to post-humans, just as it was from water-based to land-based life, then, of course, all bets are off.
Yeah, I guess that's true. Well, another thing that kind of concerns me about the different line is if machine and an AI type, is going to be what goes forth into space, then ultimately it seems to me like that, well, maybe we're sort of creating our successors. That machine intelligence will eventually replace us. And it will dominate the galaxy rather than flesh and blood type life because of its adaptability to the harsh environment.
I take it you're vaguely opposed to this idea. Well, look, think about the far future that Martin was hinting at. The days we can send essentially our brains and eyes and so forth in a whole new way to other worlds, and we will be there in a different state. It's actually sort of like being robots ourselves. I don't really see that the creation of these wonderful machines by ourselves takes away from our glory. We made them. These are our creations.
Yeah. We can only hope they feel favorable to us when their time comes, I guess. But at any rate, I just thought that was an interesting way of looking at it. But the other thing about the risk issue, I mean, the government versus, private, I mean, the government puts a lot of people at risk, like, Afghanistan, Iraq, and so forth. I mean, and those people are only semi-volunteers in that they volunteered for the military, but they didn't necessarily know where they were going to go, all of them. But the people in the astronaut corps are beyond volunteers. I mean, that's their life objective to do this stuff. So they're fully willing to take the risk, I think, as long as
should fatalities arise. Nobody questions not only the heroism, but the risk-taking. These astronauts are just as eager to take risk as any private adventurer. It's the way the public reacts to what happens when the government sends them up and they fail. But, may it not happen.
Yeah. Well, anyway, you're presenting a point of view that I've definitely heard for years. So, anyway, I just thought I'd make some comments. Until next time.
Thank you, John. Listeners, still time. Go ahead.
Yeah.
No, go ahead.
Could I just comment on what's been said? I think it's true that, as Don said, our sort of electronic progeny, as it were, will probably be near immortal, and they may start off on Mars, but they will need an atmosphere. They may prefer zero-G, and so they will go off into the blue yonder. And, of course, they could live for millions or even billions of years. And this, I think, affects the SETI searches, because the normal argument in SETI searches is to take the Drake equation and put in the life of a crescent dog civilization like ours, which people think is only a few thousand years. And that may be true, but if that crescent dog civilization creates electronic progeny, which are near immortal and go off into space, as our descendants may do in the next century or two, then that means that if there were other planets, then you'd be unlikely to detect them in the small sliver of time when they are harboring crescent dog civilizations, but we might detect the iconic remnants of that civilization. And that's why I'm optimistic about detecting evidence for something artificial in SETI searches, but I think it's going to be not a crescent dog civilization communicating, but it's going to be some electronic entities which may be the creations of some long-dead civilization, maybe long-lived, and therefore there's more chance of finding one of them. But that's a digression.
Well, it's not a big digression, because you have an email question that is asking you almost the same thing, and it's from Janice, and I'll read it, even though you've commented on most of it. Janice is in Salt Lake City, Utah, and Janice says, if we have figured out that it might be better in the long run to use AI and robotics than humans for all of the reasons, and probably other reasons as well, to what's been discussed so far, if there are extraterrestrials, they probably figured out the same thing, maybe a long, long time ago. So if there are ETs visiting Earth or flying around someplace, wouldn't it likely be their very advanced AI and robotics, probably maybe so advanced we might not be able to distinguish the fact that they're AI or robotic versus some kind of a life form? But it seems to me that what you're talking about could easily be figured out by any other civilization that was advanced enough to do some basic arithmetic. So what are your thoughts? We're visited by, or it's possibly all AI and robotics, and why? And she has one more. She has one more comment. Let me give you her last comment. I don't see any reason why the life forms that created these advanced things would perish, leaving only the robotics around as a remnant. Why wouldn't the life forms that created this stuff still be advancing? And who knows what they would be like by now?
Well,
who knows is very relevant, because speculating about
well
what happens to
that human civilization,
life forms far advanced than ours, and civilizations far more advanced, is really kind of hopeless.
And leave these electronic remnants. But if I can add one other thing, those familiar with the so-called Fermi paradox might say, isn't it surprising that we haven't been invaded by these entities, these electronic entities? But my response to that, which is a tentative one, is that whereas evolution up till now, Darwinian evolution, has favored two things. It's favored intelligence, but it's favored aggression. And people tend to feel that advanced aliens will be aggressive, they want to expand territory, etc. But this future evolution won't be Darwinian. It'll be what I like to call secular intelligent design. It'll be humans or their descendants or robots themselves designing still more sophisticated ones. And that may favor intelligence, but it may not favor aggression. And so there could be, there are all these electronic intelligences out there, but they're leading confident lives and aren't short of resources, and they're not therefore expansionist. So that's just one scenario of many scenarios.
Don, you were saying something and we couldn't understand you. You want to repeat it, please?
I see. I was only saying that when you ask about extraterrestrial visitors to Earth, figuring out what their motive would be is, in my view, rather impossible. You're just trying to extrapolate what ours would be, and we can't do it. An extraterrestrial civilization far more advanced than ours could pretty much do anything that we can't. I mean, you can't really sort of limit its powers very easily. And one of them would be, if they wanted to remain undetected, they could remain undetected. I feel certain of this. And if they wanted to be detected, why, the television shows are open. So I don't really see too much hope of ever figuring out, unless we're very lucky or there's a civilization that really would like to talk to us, what civilizations that might be visiting Earth for their own purposes are doing, because we don't know what those purposes are.
You have another email, and how are we doing on time? We're okay. This is Linda in Chicago, and said, David recently did a show with Dr. Zhu, who has a robotic and an advanced intelligence lab at the University of Hawaii. And a lot of that conversation talked about the possible evolving toward some kind of sentient robot. Do you see, as we continue to advance in AI and robotics, a type of sentient robot or advanced intelligence that could eventually one day evolve and be what we're sending into space, or what is going into space on its own? And if it was a sentient robot, might it then be too risky to send that, like a human?
I think Martin has already touched on this, so let him go on that one.
Okay. Machine intelligence is advancing fast, and although a machine could pass the Turing test, etc., behave intelligently, I don't think anyone thinks that it really has self-awareness and consciousness. That will require a robot to have a way of sensing the external world in the way we do and being aware of the external world. And I don't think that's the case for robots and powerful computers. But this may happen one day. But it's still a question that philosophers ask, is self-awareness and consciousness something which is emergent in any sufficiently complicated neural network, as it were, or is it somehow special to the flesh and blood that our brains are made of? We don't know. I think this is it's a question that academic philosophers talk about, but it may be something which practical philosophers, practical entities need to think about for the reasons you mentioned, because I think it does make a difference whether these advanced intelligences, which may perhaps go out beyond the solar system, whether they are zombies or whether they have self-awareness. And I think if these entities are intelligent in a way but have no self-consciousness and awareness, we think it's rather sad if we are usurped by them, because there'd be nothing to appreciate the wonder and mystery of the cosmos if we do. Through our self-awareness. And so I think the question of whether these far future entities, which may supersede us, are zombie-like or have consciousness, which is still an open question, it does matter for how we react to this possible long-range scenario.
And probably no way to predict how we would react to something like that, is there?
No.
Your book has been out for a while. Have you gotten any feedback from government sources that support this idea? Is it something that might be considered by policymakers down the road, and maybe even policymakers and space people outside the United States? I note that you're both in the UK, and they have an active space agency now.
We in Europe have a European Space Agency, which is a very successful outfit, and in terms of scientific programs, it's really, I think, matched NASA's efforts. It's based with programs like Planck and most recently Gaia, which has got data on 2 billion stars in the galaxy. And these amazing things which have been done by European scientists. But of course, our overall budget for space is smaller, and we've been able to do these things because we don't spend a big chunk of it on the human space flight. We're starting to, and I, from what I've said, not surprised, I'm not in favor of that. I think we can stick to robotics for exploration and fabricating huge structures like solar energy collectors and telescopes in space.
Gentlemen, I know we're coming up on the end of the hour, but there are currently multiple space tourism flights happening, mostly with Blue Origin, and mostly they're suborbital. They go up and come back down. But there have been some flights with SpaceX on Dragon, and some more are planned. If a really horrible accident happened with one of these private commercial companies in space tourism, do you think the ramifications of that accident and the loss of crew would spill over into impacting human spaceflight for the government?
It would certainly cause people to think
and
about
that's
it.
That's why
I think of the difference.
Hold on.
Government.
You're talking over one another, so one at a time, because okay. You guys.
I'm sorry, go
cell phone. So, Martin, you first, okay?
Okay, yes. That's why in our book we say that these private companies should not talk about space tourism. They should talk about space adventure. Because if people think it's tourism, like going in an aircraft, then, of course, those disasters, if they happen, will have a big effect, just like air crashes do if they become too frequent. But if it's presented as a space adventures for people like those who go hang gliding in Yosemite and manifestly dangerous effects, then I think the reaction would not be so severe. People would say that's the way they wanted to go.
Don, you were going to say something?
Yeah, I was only stressing the difference in public reaction. If some bold space adventurers were killed doing what they liked, people would say that it's really too bad, but other space adventurers will take up the challenge, whereas with the government, even though the astronauts would be equally bold, the government would essentially have financed this sad result. And I would see the public's having a big difference because they look to NASA, for example, as not exactly guaranteeing safety, but really working hard at it, which they do for really publicity and other reasons.
Interesting. Now, I think if it happened with SpaceX and a Dragon capsule, which is also being used to take people to the space station, there might be a different public reaction with both NASA and the public. But I don't know. And I kind of like the idea of saying space adventure rather than space tourism. I think the adventure is much more of a descriptive term.
Excellent.
Gentlemen, as we're coming up on the end of the hour, have we missed anything that you wanted to talk about in the book? Do you want to add anything that we've omissed or maybe misunderstood or something? Don, you want to tell us if we've missed something, and then I'll ask Martin.
There's an arcane chapter on space law because I've also been a lawyer, which I enjoyed writing. You can have a look if you want to read about it and see there isn't much.
Do you think that it'll evolve to something like astral law, like a lot of people talk about, or it's just not
going
to be much?
There will be conflicts. There'll be, you know, commercial conflicts, personal conflicts. All sorts of things will be transmogrified into a space concept.
Martin, anything that we've omitted or overlooked or that you would like to continue to add in our discussion today?
Yes. Well, I was going to mention space law, on which Don is the expert, not me. But we do address some sort of practical details, and our focus is mainly on the next few decades. We have a few speculations at the end, and we've spent some time on those in this interesting discussion. But the book is mainly about things which are being planned now. In other words, things that are going to happen in the next 50 years. And I hope people will enjoy it.
Well, I've certainly enjoyed it, and I have read it. Real quickly, do you think, either of you, that we will see the day where there are property rights in space similar to property rights that people have here on Earth? I know property rights in space are a big issue. I know it's hard to spring that on you at the end of the program. But any quick thoughts on property rights down the road?
Sure. The answer is eventually yes, because conflict will be forced to be adjudicated in some way. We first sort of extra legally and later legally. There'll be a whole structure in place, but it will take a while.
Martin, any different opinion from that, or the same thing?
No, I agree with that completely.
Okay, well, we're at the hour, and I know, Don, you have a hard stop, so I want to thank you both for being on the program. It's a great book, people, and it's thought-provoking, and it'll do you good to read it and to consider some things other than just the typical space advocacy perspective. And it's been a great pleasure to have you on the show, and we will archive it and have it posted, and it'll be playing before the weekend comes up. So, again, I want to thank you both for being with us, and great book, and I hope you do more of them together. It makes us think, and that's always a good thing. So,
thank you. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you, David.
Yes. And, listeners, that's it. So we want to thank Martin and Don and all of you who participated with calls and emails. The weekend is here, so have a great weekend and keep it safe as always. And, as always, keep looking up. So, once again, goodbye from Martin, Don, David, and the Space Show.